Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hang On To Your Hat, episode 32. And in the studio today, we have Anthony
Breslin.
You're a beauty.
Bad Daddy, you're a naughty boy.
These days, fatherhood is everywhere. You can't get away from it. Not that blokes haven't tried. If you're not a father, you've got a father. You're a son of a dad or a daughter of a bloke. But either way, being a dad is no picnic. The fear, the anger, the confusion and, well, the love, of course. Derek Myers and Dan Lee, together with their special guests, are here to share the highs and lows, the joys and the agony of being a modern dad. But most of all, to let you know that you're not alone.
There it is, Derek. Seems like it's been ages since we've been in here.
It actually has been ages.
Yeah. I'm out of something, out of my mind.
Is it fresh again? The sound of Sammy screaming?
Yes, it's wonderful.
So he'd be mature now, Sammy, wouldn't
he? Yeah, he's 27. Yeah. 27. Yeah, yeah. An accountant. We have with us Anthony Breslin, my old mate. My old mate, Anthony Breslin, how long ago did I meet you? I have no idea. 20 years ago?
Oh, God, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Would have been, was it early 90s?
Yeah, I was just trying to think when. Anthony's a painter, and I remember meeting you when, at some point back then, and you dressed in very colourful clothes and very painterly kind of clothes, and I was super impressed and jealous of that.
Really?
And
I didn't know that till now.
Well, because painters seem to, and you embodied this very well, like seem to become like the art they're doing a bit,
yep.
And it's so physical compared to being a writer and all in your head and on a keyboard. It was like you had your work pants were just covered in coloured paint, and it was all just like you were so it was such a physical and immersive kind of thing. And somewhere near that early time, I got a corner of your studio to write in.
Yeah, right?
That's somewhere near the early days, and watching you come in and work, and then like do some big painting, and then cut it to pieces, and stick bits of it on other paintings, and then like it was just so opposite to my existence, which was this kind of neurotic, internalized.
Did it make you feel guilty just when you just sit there? You know, I've only imagined. I've seen painters work a bit,
yeah,
not a great deal. But writers, I can only imagine you just kind of sit there. It's then horrible. You go get a coffee, then you sit there.
And you're not.
I don't
moving.
Know. My only imagination of writing is just to sit there wishing you were writing.
Yeah. Like, I'm going to get one of those stand up desks so I can move around too. And because I just loved the physicality of what you were doing. And I just was so envious of that. I've often thought about being a painter just so that I could stand back from the work.
Yeah. Well, my art was very physical, you know, and I was covered in paint. All my clothes were covered in paint because it became my full-time living, and I had all these contracts I had to fill. I had to make art for all these different shows all around Australia and overseas. And so I was just covered in paint all the time because I had to keep working and working and working to live up to all the shows I had lined up ahead of time.
So it's a practical thing, but the irony is it becomes a kind of expression of not a fashion expression exactly, but it's very strikingly.
Yeah, I wasn't really conscious of that.
No,
but then also I end up developing performance pieces based around the act of creation.
Yeah,
based on what I was doing in the studio, I took it into a theatre, and
yes,
that was the next extension.
Oh, that's right, and then it was called Tribe, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was
paint an opera in paint.
Yeah, and you sort of rolled around. You had dancers,
and musicians,
with
and
paint
I
on their bodies.
Designed all their costumes and their outfits.
Oh, that sounds way better than Ken Doan and Morrison. Remember the Ken Doan and the trumpet?
James Morrison.
James Morrison,
yeah.
Now, this was very physical and very difficult physically.
Yeah.
I had to train to do it, and it was very successful.
Oh, wow.
We did quite a lot of shows.
Yeah.
Did a big season at Chapel Off Chapel.
I found it liberating, and it was the antithesis to what I was I was getting further into my head and my alcoholism. In fact, I used to pass out and sleep in your studio sometimes, didn't
I? I used to come in the morning to work, and you'd be lying on the floor, and I'd put a blanket over you and try and put something under your head, and then I wouldn't put the music up too high, and you just sleep through the music. So I tried to make you comfortable all the time.
Anthony's a deeply kind and generous person, and has always been. And this is something I love about him, and but having that ability to watch, to be part of your studio and be in there and see all that, it just helped me to sort of try and get out of my head a little bit. Like, a person like me shouldn't really be a writer.
But then when you started putting those big pieces of paper on the wall.
That's right.
And turning it into an act of theatre, I thought that was really great.
Well, exactly.
And writing on them.
And I still sort of do that now. I still have big sheets of paper, which probably came from that experience of – so I'm in there with your stuff and it's my little
I suggested it to you, actually.
Yeah, you probably did.
I said to you, why don't you put sheets of paper on the wall?
Yeah.
Because we were talking about how we do our practices and write on those sheets so it's more physical.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I write too and I'm working on my third book at the moment and it's such a different process to be in
– yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of just an endurance race to try and write a book is full on.
I'm interested in how
pull it out, externalise it like that is so good.
Yeah, I'm interested in how you're a visual artist, successful visual artist, and then what sort of triggered the whole idea of doing the physical stage play thing? Where people keep commenting, wow, the way you paint is poetic, or like, was it about feedback? Was Danny going, wow, it's amazing how you...
Some people come to the studio, I very rarely let people watch me work.
Yeah.
Because I was so physical, like I was an athlete, you know. I'd competed in powerlifting competitions and bodybuilding competitions and I was fully into training. I was very fit, very strong. So I use that in my work and my work is very physical. And by doing it, I thought I could turn this into a piece of theatre. But the first time I really did it was in my opera. I went to Myers in Melbourne and said to them, you know, can I have all your windows? I want to make 100 paintings in a week and sell them through the window and have raised money for charity for these TLC for Kids, which helps sick kids. I didn't think Myers were going to actually give me the most expensive retail windows in Australia.
Yeah.
But they did. Not only did they give them to me, they designed them all, put my name all over it, did flyers all through the city, was on the news 3 times. It was a huge project. So I raised $24,000. I was exhausted at the end of the week because I was working 8 hours a day making paintings and people were coming to the windows, crowds of people and pointing, I want number 22 and number 23. So I had staff coming in, grabbing the painting off the wall. Myers would wrap it and they'd give it to the client. And the client would be waving at the window going, got my painting. It was amazing because you raised so much money and then I donated all that money to our surfer kids. And that started the whole theatrical beginnings of what was possible. So I did a lot of projects like that. I was back in Myers Windows 3 years later doing painting celebrities into this invention of an upright painting that I invented because they came to me and said, we want you to paint these celebrities like Molly Meldrum and Helen Capolis and who else was it? Vanessa Amorosi and Ron Barassi. And I said, I don't want to paint portraits of them in the window. That's just the conventional thing an artist is supposed to do.
Yeah.
I'll paint them into my own paintings. So they have to come in white jumpsuits and I'll paint them so they'll disappear into this huge head.
They're physically in the
like a mobile. So I was always, it was like me against time.
Yes.
The athlete as the artist. I had 50 minutes to do it and I had to kill myself to do it. So that's began the whole process of doing all this performance stuff, which led to my operas and all that kind of stuff as well.
Wow, what a fantastic journey.
And also what I got from being around you working was that this idea that – well, you were killing your darlings all the time because I always talk about how you did this amazing painting and then I'd be looking at it because I'm just sitting there and I'd be looking at it for a week and really getting familiar with it and then you'd come in and slash it, take a piece of it out and stick it on something else and stuff. And your attitude was very about the process and it doesn't matter about the outcome in a way. It's much more dynamic than that and you don't sort of own this. And a lot of our discussion came out of that, I reckon.
Yeah, and that's where the performance stuff came from. Yeah, but also, if I wasn't happy with something, I didn't care what other people thought of it. They said, it's great, we love it. I said, no, I'm not happy with it, I'm slashing it.
Yeah.
And I'd slash it and recycle the bits that worked and use them in other paintings.
And just do it. Like, you don't have to – so what if it's
– no, but I had to finish a lot of paintings because I was doing 6 or 7 solo shows a year. And I had to supply 30 paintings for those shows at least. And then I started getting orders from overseas where I had to do 60 paintings, 50 paintings for other galleries that wanted to on-sell them. And it became crazy.
So you can't be precious in a way with that. Well,
there's a line you got to draw, but I was obsessive, completely obsessive, workaholic.
Yeah.
You know, pushing myself to the limit all the time. So I just worked around the clock.
Yeah.
And if I needed drugs to help me get through the night to keep working, I would do that too, you know. But so I pushed everything to number 11. Because to have a career on that level for that many years takes a lot out of you, and I think that's probably the reason why I ended up getting cancer. Yeah.
Yeah. So then, well, that's been the other huge thing for you in recent time. Like, when did you get the leukemia?
I got diagnosed in 2014, the middle, and I had a bone marrow transplant in 2015. And it's been brutal because the bone marrow transplant's brutal. My brother had the same leukemia as me, and he died. He didn't get through the transplant.
Right.
So I survived the transplant, but I know I'm paying the price. I've got a disease now that cripples me from the transplant, and I've got stage 5 kidney failure. So I'm walking around with stage 5 kidney failure now.
You've had that for a while, though.
I have, and I keep hovering above going back on dialysis again or needing a kidney transplant. I keep using all different alternative therapies to try and keep me from having a kidney transplant.
The graft versus host is such a fucking tragedy in that you know, you get the cancer cured, don't you?
Yeah.
Ostensibly, but then your body starts fighting the graft. Yeah. So then it's fucking disintegrating parts of your body.
No, most people don't understand what graft versus host disease is, but it's terrible disease. It causes me, pain every day from my legs to my eyes because it attacks all my body. It attacks my back. I've got graft versus host disease all in my stomach. My stomach's like full of rocks.
So it's sort of like scar tissue and stuff, is it?
Yeah, build up of just the new immune system rejecting your body and attacking you everywhere.
It doesn't happen to everyone or it's a unavoidable part of...
Some people it doesn't happen to, but like I met a guy in hospital. I still spend a lot of time in hospital because I've got so many problems. I met a guy not too long ago in hospital that didn't have any graft versus host disease, had a transplant.
Wow.
His came back. That's what happens.
Oh, right.
Because the rejection of the new immune system attacking the body kills off any existence of the old stem cells that could be there or the old leukemia that can come back. So it keeps it at bay. So if you don't get any graft versus host disease, you're highly susceptible to getting back what you had. And when that happens, you're dead.
So you want – well, so the graft versus host is a good sign – initially.
Yeah.
See, this is where it's such a
You want a little bit of it, idea. But mine's severe.
Yeah,
mine's
same with
worse
mine,
than most
friends.
People. Yeah.
So is this terrible. Is it manageable? Does it fade away or is this just how
it can
is?
Burn out.
Yeah.
They reckon mine won't burn out, but you just don't know. So I've got lots of alternative therapists I work with to do everything I can to stay, you know, keep going.
Is that as well as what the medicine men say?
The doctors, all the doctors can give me is immunosuppressants.
Yeah.
And the immunosuppressants they've given me to keep me alive in the past when the graft versus host disease was really bad have given me osteoporosis, kidney failure, and wrecked my eyes with cataracts. I just had two operations on my eyes. Whoa. So the repercussions of the medication is if you survive it, the medication. And I've just had, you know, cancer cut off my face, warts cut off my face, and cysts cut off my face, all caused from immunosuppressant drugs. So they stuff you up in so many other ways, that's for sure.
Yeah,
all the medication
it's taking
does.
With one hand and taking away with the other.
It's tough.
And in the middle of all that... You had a kid.
I had a kid, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Do you want me to tell you about that?
Yeah,
I'd love to.
Well, when I had my career going, everything, I was a bit of a womanizer. I had, you know, lots of different flings and affairs all over the place. And one of them ended up becoming pregnant. And she refused to have an abortion and wanted to have the child. And I was really didn't want her to at all. Right. Even though part of me felt guilty.
What age were you?
In my 40s, 43.
Yep.
It was very confronting for me to have somebody, decide to have a child, that was partially mine, of course, that I didn't want one to have. And I felt guilty wanting her to have an abortion, but I just didn't want that responsibility. I didn't want to be tied to her for the rest of my life when I didn't have the feelings for her that I was going to be in a relationship with her. But she refused and she was going to have the child. So then I had to emotionally do a flip around because I was never going to not acknowledge my child and not be part of his life. So then I had to accept it and go with it. But I think what was the most confronting thing for me was that there was part of me that was, because of my upbringing, what I'd been through, I was brought up in a pretty tough environment. My mother was depressed all the time. My father was an alcoholic. He used to beat me on the weekends and my brother up. I didn't want to be vulnerable to being in love with my own child. I didn't want all that was going to bring with it, all the pain and potential suffering of being attached and being vulnerable. I didn't want – that's probably the thing that I – why I didn't want to have a child and why I avoided it, tried to avoid it. But
understand that fear.
Yeah, you're expired.
Even when you're deliberately trying to get a kid, you have that fear.
Yeah, it's funny. You're suddenly vulnerable, right?
Yeah, you're vulnerable. Yeah you are. If you're trying to avoid being vulnerable, it's tough because you can't really – unless you just decide not to be part of the kid's life, and I couldn't do that.
No, well, that's right. And it's a great vulnerability.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt. I mean, you know, the potential for pain and loss.
Yeah.
But, you know, vulnerability's, important, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you're running hot. Yeah. You're fit, successful. Womanizing artist.
Yeah, I had a awesome career. I was traveling the world, had a great career. Everything was on number 11. Yeah. It was, you know, it was hard work and it was dysfunctional on many levels, you know. But it was also, you know, awesome to have that opportunity to be able to make a really good living out of being an artist and not having to compromise and doing exactly what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it was fantastic, you know, to have that because it's so rare that in Australia. And I managed that for nearly 20 years doing that.
Yeah. On the rare front, how many peers would you have at or above your level? Like, would you know? Would you have a? Is it like rock stars where you're gonna gotta go hang with each other because no one else understands the pressure or anything like that?
I didn't have many. No, that's
Dan's
for sure.
Laughing because my naivety is just beyond comprehension.
I didn't have many, no. But it's different. I guess I can only speak for myself, of course, but being an artist is different from being a singer, for example. If you know, there's a lot of work goes into making a song, I know, but when you made the song, it can be reproduced over and over again. Yeah. My art was about me making every single bit of it. I never had any assistance to people making my art. They couldn't. And so I've got to keep on manufacturing all the time.
Yeah.
And it's unrelenting at that level that I was at because I wasn't putting the prices up and up and up all the time. They sold for quite a few $1,000s each. But, you know, if you're selling $30,000 paintings, you don't have to make a huge amount of them to make good money. Mm. But then 50% of it's going to your dealers, 9 dealers in every state, taking 50%. And 10%, it would cost me to make a painting because mine were quite expensive to produce. Yeah. Mm. So you have to make a lot of paintings and sell a lot of paintings to make money, you know.
So the perception is you're a multi, you know, you must be a multi-thousandaire or a multi-millionaire. The perception is, wow, that guy must be doing well. But the reality, as always, is what you get.
Success
is probably about the same.
No, but I was grateful to make a good living out of it.
Someone doing well in their normal career. You know,
definitely
make
grateful. And I own my apartment now from paintings. And I ended up buying a church and converting it into an arts hub and building three floors there and becoming the builder because I was just unstoppable, you know. And we ran classes there, had big exhibitions there, put a cafe in there. It was a big, big production.
Wow, where was that?
Yeah, in Carnegie. It was called the Breslin Gallery.
Yeah.
But then I got struck with leukemia and then I couldn't manage it anymore. I was, you know, it was going to kill me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in hospital all the time and I didn't know how long I was going to survive. So,
man, that's such difficult. A sudden smack stop, right? When you're moving that fast and then
It was a massive change in my life. I mean, it came on so quickly.
Yeah.
I got diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, which is a blood cancer. And then I went off to do an ayahuasca retreat and the ayahuasca retreat really took it out of me.
Yeah.
And a few days later, I was diagnosed with full-blown leukemia, rushed to hospital. Before I knew it, I had a drip in me and I was on chemotherapy. And I thought, I can't believe this is happening to me. The shock was just brutal. And two days before that happened, my father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So we were both in the Alfred together, different wards. Yeah.
It's just it's uncomprehendable.
And I was back in the ward when my brother died as well. So it was a pretty trippy experience.
Did he die while you were... that recently?
No, he died quite a few years ago, but I was in the same ward that he was in. on chemotherapy and going and thinking, I'm going to die too, because that's what happened to him. He got the same leukemia as me and he died. And I just thought, well, I'm going to die too.
So how do you process that, or do can you, when all this is going on, are you able to, what's your thought processes about?
At the beginning, I was afraid and in shock.
Mm.
But then I guess I had a very strong meditation practice and yoga practice, and that really helped me a lot, because I suffered a lot, especially the first few months, because I spent 2 5-week periods in isolation. I wasn't allowed to go outside. I wasn't allowed to go out of the room. I was locked in a room for nearly 6 weeks, twice.
Is that the immunosuppressant thing?
Yeah, because I had no immune system, and they had to get me, because I had MDS, it was making it very slow for the chemotherapy to put me into remission, and then it took ages to put me into remission. And I had a virus and only died from that. I was shaking for days trying to ride it off because my immune system was so repressed. But once I got through that 6 weeks, they let me out for 2 weeks, and then I could hear the birds, feel the sun, put my feet on the grass again, all those things you take for granted. I just looking at a window every day and drawing all the time. That's all I was doing.
It's that irony, isn't it, of getting really sick, that you start to value things correctly when it's taken away or threatened to be taken away. Like if you had such a fast lifestyle and then, you know, having to stop and then...
Yeah. There was a big lesson in seeing that I was running away from myself my whole life.
Mm.
I was driven all the time to escape my own, sitting with my own silence. And being in that situation, I had no choice. I had to sit with what was happening and my own mortality.
Mm.
And that's what I did. I treated it as a second life for how long. It might have been last for a week or a month. But I had the opportunity to dig deep and to really go into myself.
Mm.
And when I did, the fear was gone, and I was very happy to die in many ways. I was kind of ready as I could be. You know, very accepting of my situation and less attached to being what I thought I wanted to be before I got sick, if that makes sense.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's sort of the work that we should all do at some point, right, with our lives. But it takes having to have everything stripped away from you.
And a lot of people say the best thing that ever happened to them was they got cancer.
Yeah, I've heard that
too. You know, and if I had just got cancer, that would have been bad enough. But because I've had all these other cards dealt to me as well, it's been an endurance race.
Yeah.
And I've had 3 bouts of double pneumonia as well. So I've nearly 5 times I've been about to die, and I somehow didn't. I come back, and even though I've been on life support, I've been in intensive care, I've been on the works, you know.
Every time I call you, you go, you've just nearly died again.
Yeah.
I'm like, fucking hell.
It wasn't that long ago that I nearly died again. And I just think it's a running joke in my head, because I just think it's not me. There's greater forces at play that just go, it's not your time, you're staying.
Well, you got to, how else can you look at it?
And I take responsibility, because I've watched so many people in the hospital die.
Mm.
And I've watched friends die. Not long ago, about 2 months ago, I watched a friend die from leukemia. They were trying to get her ready for a bone marrow transplant, and she just wasn't strong enough, you know. And I was mentoring her, trying to help her, because she was really afraid. And she had a little girl, a daughter. And I would say to her, look, you know, you don't own your daughter. She's not your possession.
Mm.
She's got a life. She's got her own adventures to have. And she's going to go on whether you're there or not, because she has her own trajectory. And that's how I see my relationship with my son. I don't own him. He's not my possession.
Right.
And that helps in a way too, I think. And she found it hard to get her head around that, but then she started to. Mm. I said to her, you got to look after yourself. You've got to go into yourself. Mm. You can't facilitate your child. There's other people around to help you and support you. They're there, you know, because it's just too difficult to do both at the same time.
And I imagine you'd be in danger of trying to jam, you know, 15 years of parenting into an unknown period of time. You don't know what you've got left.
Yeah.
And it's frightening, especially when you're sick and you're trying to process your own mortality, all these things at the same time. It could, you know, potentially be, if done wrong, could be maybe damaging for the kid, because you're just like, you know, just trying to jam them with advice or parenting or something like that.
Mm.
That's
quite an intense process for her.
Yeah.
And I was hung out with her kid and her while she was really going through a lot of really tough stuff. And in the end, she died. She started to die. I went in, rushed into the hospital, sat with her and watched her die. And her little daughter was coming in and out of the room because she didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah.
She knew her mother was going and she wasn't going to come back. But it was a very strange situation.
Oh.
But that's unfortunately life. And I've seen lots of people, I've sat with quite a few people and watched them die. And you become less afraid of it and you see it as a natural process. And
this is the crazy thing. It's as big as life. Right?
But we hide it and we don't like talking about it. And that's a shame, I think.
And it's not that we shouldn't be terrified or frightened. We should be whatever we are toward it. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to get any better at processing it or dare I say, get the benefits of it. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's certainly, like you said, there's positives or there's work that you get to do because of that. And see and feel things and not take them for granted, you know.
Yeah.
As bad as it is, like we sort of waste death.
But one of the biggest superpowers that humans have that maybe other animals might not have is the ability to completely and utterly go into denial of things.
Yeah.
Right? And we live our whole lives in denial.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a percentage game.
Yeah.
Go through all this when you're 50.
Mm.
It's you're really going, oh, you know, like when do people say it's too soon or it's a tragedy? And it does, and it's just like it's limited anyway. It's coming.
I know it's coming. We've got to start getting.
And I'm just
over
amazed
that.
At my own.
Our culture just doesn't want to deal with it at all.
Yeah.
And I'm really into it. I mean, I talk about it all the time because I don't see any difference between death and life in many ways.
Right. Especially when it's you're just. You're so fully pushed into a position where you have to face it. It's amazing that it takes us that often to and it's just a thing, right?
Well, even when I went to India before I got sick, I watched about 50 cremations. I'd watch them bring all the bodies down and put them on the fires. I'd just stand there right in front of the body and watch it burn because I wanted to do that because that's the process of life right in front of you. And here everything's hidden away. Because I spend so much time in hospital, I see so many people that are sick, so many people that are suffering, get to know people who are about to die and watch them die. And that's reality. But it's all put away in wards where people, the average person doesn't have to deal with it. They don't have to see it, you know. And so it's not part of their life. Mm. So they just avoid having to deal with or thinking about death because it's not in front of them. It's not around them. And I think that's a real loss.
Yeah.
So and also there's this fear that this is the only life I have. This is the end. And because I don't think that way, I'm doing a meditation practice every day and even using experimental plant medicines to help transcend the mind and take the mind to other places, I find has helped me a lot to have 1 foot here and 1 foot somewhere else all the time.
So you're doing important work.
Well, yeah, I think it's important for me because I feel like I'm ready on most days to go in many ways.
Like
I'm not overly attached to being here anymore.
Packed at the door there.
Yeah, I'm not living for my son either, so I'm not attached to being here because he needs me. Sure, I'd like to be around and see him grow up, but if I'm not, it's okay. He'll be okay because he has his own life to lead.
And getting that perspective as a parent is really good. I mean, I try to remind myself of that with my kids when I'm worrying too much about their life to come, you know, and I have to go, well, it's not for me. They are, like you said, their own entity.
Yeah.
They're their own self and I don't own them. I've brought them in and I'm going to try to protect them basically, but we overprotect them too, you know.
No, because we think definitely do.
We have this weird possession thing of it. It's kind of like you're on your own, son.
Yeah.
A bit.
Yeah.
And
we usually, I think in many ways, we project that overprotection onto our children because we have that over preciousness about ourselves.
Yeah, right.
You know? Yeah, so it just
definitely
transpires to the child.
Well, that's
you know?
What's happened with you. You became less self-oriented through this.
Yeah.
So you're able to let go of him a bit more and let him be have his journey.
Yeah. Yeah.
How old was he when you got sick?
How old was he when I got sick?
Like you had a relationship with him already.
Oh yeah, I was there for the birth, and I was totally into it. I was his mother had a cesarean and she was really sick. So I slept on the floor of her house and looked after her for the first 10 days and did the best I could to help her with him and everything. So I was exhausted. So I got an indication of, you know, sleeplessness because she couldn't walk. She was really in a lot of pain. And then from then on, I was down there all the time, seeing him, having him overnight, looking after him, taking him out for the day, taking him to school, all that kind of stuff, you know. And then she met a guy. It was her cousin's friend who was over from the Netherlands, and they fell in love straight away and they began this relationship because she wanted to have a relationship with me, but I didn't want to have a relationship with her. I wanted to be in her life and be friends with her and parent the child together, and we did that. Once I got my head around it all, we did that really well. But then when she fell for him, he wanted her to come over to Holland. So she asked me for permission to go to Holland, and I said, oh, sure, but how long are you going to go for? And she said, a month. I said, okay. So it was difficult to let him go for a month, but I did. And then she rang me from Holland and said, I got something to tell you. And I'm like, what? And she goes, I'm pregnant again. I'm going, what? So she wanted to stay for 3 months in Holland. So I found that really difficult because I couldn't make her come back. I didn't know if she was ever going to come back, if I was ever going to see my son again. I started going down the track of I'm never going to see him again, you know, blah, blah, blah. She came back after 3 months, but it was very difficult because she came back with him, and by then he was all over him and treating him like his father. All the work I'd put in, I felt like, you know, was down the toilet because I'd start all over again. And part of me wanted to give up at that point. I didn't want to start from scratch and go through, you know, getting to know my son and getting him to know me all over again.
Because at that age, 3 months is a long time, right?
It was a few years into – he was a few years old now. And it was difficult. But I had to do that. I had to – but the stepfather's a lovely guy and we got along very well. And I started from scratch again and built up a relationship with him again and let him – I also had to adjust to the fact he was calling his stepfather dad – as well as me. So he had two dads, and I had to get over that pretty quickly and think, well, it's probably a good thing he's got two dads. But then the next thing that happened was I got diagnosed with cancer, and that changed everything again. It made it really difficult to father my child. I couldn't have him overnight. He couldn't understand what was happening to me. He came into hospital to see me a few times, but it was difficult, really challenging.
Well, it's in some ways, that situation where you've got your son has a mother who's raising another family and stuff like that, and a partner who she loves. So it's kind of got to be comforting in some ways knowing that your son is all right. Like, can you imagine what it might feel like if, like, let's say you're raising a child on your own and then you got sick? Like, it's got to be a bit frightening like that.
Yeah, I was really happy that she met him because he's a lovely guy and it's really made her life, you know, wonderful being with him. And I really love the other two kids they've got now. They're great. So it's turned out well overall, but it was very hard to let them go and live in Holland. That was the next stage that happened. Because they came to me, it was a bit of a shock when they said, we want to move to Holland because he's Dutch. But he said to me, it's not my idea to move to Holland. I would never do that. It's Lisa's idea. She wants to try something different, and they asked me if it was okay if they went. And that was a really difficult decision because we all cried together and held each other. And I said, look, he's not my possession, and I can't look after him because I don't know how long I'm going to be around for. And I'm too sick. I'm too unwell. So the best thing I can do is let you have the life that you want and let you go. And so that's what I did.
Man, hard. There's just been this so many challenges in a row.
There's been a few. They're all been really difficult and confronting, but they also help you grow a lot too. You're forced to grow. And you're forced to kind of practice what you believe. It's easy for me to say, I don't own my son. He's not my possession. I want the best for him, and the best for him is often not to be with me because I can't look after him. I can't give him what he needs. So I have to let him go, you know, and that's not easy, but you have to practice what you believe.
So it's like this whole thing has kept just pushing you to do that, to really put your make your actions match your beliefs and your talk, you know.
Yeah, I think that's important.
Which most of us never have
to do. Yeah, because I think that lots of people have ethics, you know, obviously, but their ethics can change according to who's around. If there's nobody around and they find a wallet, ethically they might decide to talk themselves into keeping it.
Yes.
But if they find a wallet and there's two of their friends next to them, they might decide, oh, look, in front of their friends to proclaim, I'm going to bring it down to the police station because it's the right thing to do. And I think ethics are something that
Split it three ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Ethics is something that are internal and they shouldn't change according to what's around. Yeah. So, and I'm really into that idea. So that's I've got to kind of follow through with that the best I can.
Do you use Skype and all these modern ways to chat?
Yeah, we talk most weeks. We talk on the phone, and that's being got better and better. You know,
does he have a better grasp of your illness and health issues now?
Not really. I mean, he's that age where he doesn't ask me how I am or what I'm going through, you know. And
it's been like that for as long as he can remember, presumably, too.
Yeah, well, just recently I talked to him on Skype or on Messenger or whatever it is, WhatsApp. And half my face was bandaged up because he's had an eye operation. And I just said to him, like you said, an eye operation, that's why my face is bandaged up. But does he ask me any questions about it? No. He just talks to me like there's nothing, half my face isn't bandaged up. You know,
let's talk about Minecraft. It's weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? My 9-year-old daughter wrote me an apology, 2-page apology letter the other day because I was like, been getting the migraines a bit, right? And I just go, kids, I'm all right. I can function. I can cook you dinner and do all this stuff. But don't sit either side of me and have a screaming match at each other. Because it just changes the way I hear your voices.
Mm.
So I love you and I love hearing your stories, but you just fuck off, right, basically.
Yeah.
Right? And then it came to a head where they're screaming and carrying on and I'm going, oh, this is – please just I'm begging you, just leave me alone. And then she's come back and the letter said – I should have brought it to read it because my memory is terrible. But it pretty much says – I'm really so sorry, Dad. I love you. Blah, blah, blah. The usual kind of apology. Page 2. I hope you get over these migraines because, you know, then you can spend more time listening to how we feel.
Yeah.
Rather than just how you feel. It's like, oh.
It's the butt page. There's the butt page.
There's the burn. Sorry, yeah, butt. The butt. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, fair enough. They don't.
No,
yeah,
they're so not funny, kids.
I'm happy for them to not.
No idea that you're actually a separate entity,
and
that you have your own issues, your own things going on.
Superhuman, aren't you?
Well, and you've been a certain thing to them forever too. It's not until you have. I didn't find when I had kids of my own was when I started talking with my parents differently. Like I was able to because we were both parents.
The classic apology phone call.
That's right. Yeah. My brother did that. Well, straight away you stop any kind of blame you have for, you know, like suddenly any problems you had are just like marveling at how they coped at all.
Yeah.
With having us. And then also wanting to just talk as adults now and let go of any kind of, you know, grievances between, like forget about feeling bad about something you did when I was a kid or whatever. We're both parents now. We're on the same.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Let's talk honestly what it was like. And both my parents, I've kind of grilled a bit to say, what was it like in your actual emotional experience being 23 and having kids and, you know, big parties and like, well, the fuck, 23. Jesus. And
it's hard
Christ.
To comprehend, especially if you had kids older what it's like to have kids at 19 or 20, you know, it'd be intense experience.
Yeah, and
especially having 4 or 5 of them, like those older generations did, like my parents did. And
I saw a friend of ours yesterday who's just had a baby and about 6 weeks ago or something like that, and so she's all underslept and she's been at home with the baby. Her husband's been working and she lives next door and she's sort of, there's a bit of a manic thing going on of just like, and isolation and all that stuff. And we were talking about how suddenly the judgmental switch goes off. You know, like you used to look at people in the supermarket with their kids getting angry or whatever. You're like, oh, that's terrible parents and all that sort of stuff. And suddenly now you're like, you just don't blame any parent. All parents are now allies.
I just said to a guy at school pickup, he had his little one with him to pick up his daughters at the school, and his son was literally in the middle of where the bell went and all the kids came running out. His little kid, I couldn't tell you an age, but was literally full tantruming on his back, full volume, right? Full volume in the schoolyard. Yeah. And he's just sitting there, this like 6 foot something Irish guy, really reasonably fresh immigrant. And I was like, I said, oh, I've got to confess, mate. He goes, what? I said, I actually get pleasure out of this. He goes, what? I said, I don't know. Because it's not mine. Because there's peace in my house right now. I get a pleasure out of just knowing that there wasn't something I was doing wrong. They're all doing it. And that's what it is.
A recalibration happens, doesn't it? And you think, oh, shit, it's like it's so complex what it's doing to your sense of self, all your life trajectory.
And if you end up with kids that have got Asperger's or autism or physical disability – it can be really tough. There's a lot of Asperger's in my family. My niece, my nephews,
judgy old
Asperger's,
people.
And it's tough. Yeah, really tough. Mm. You have a tough time with them.
Yeah,
do crazy shit.
Yeah. And but then it's like with everything. It's everyone finds a way, don't they?
Yeah.
And you can't really, even though we always do compare ourselves to other parents. You know, like I seem to be coping less well, and I have it much easier than some people. Ostensibly.
Yeah.
But we're all different people with different, thresholds and abilities.
Exactly.
And, you know.
So complex, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you – yeah, right. So you weren't able to see him much. Well, did he move pretty quickly after you got sick? No.
He moved about a year or so ago, and I was sick 5 years ago. Yeah. So he was around for a while, and I was still seeing him the best I could. But it was difficult. I couldn't have him overnight. I'd see him, but I couldn't have him overnight. I was having him overnight for a few days in a row.
And it's probably highly dangerous to have kids of that age.
Yeah, disease.
We know they're like little like petri dishes.
Oh,
aren't
yeah,
they?
That's true. That's true.
It's not going to be good to have around.
No. And I just haven't got the energy because I've got chronic fatigue too from my from the graft versus host disease has given me chronic fatigue.
Right.
So I've got very poor endurance. I've got, and my muscles are all extremely weak now. I've gone from being a strong athlete to being very weak. Every morning I get up and try and do 3 push-ups, and it's very difficult because my
whole
body is 3
more than what I can do.
But I'm a wreck. I used to run around with him, play with him, and do all kinds of things. Take him to do all these. I got him into rock climbing, but I can't do any of those things. I can't even ride a bike. You know, I can't walk that far. So all that was taken away.
That's a cruel contrast.
When you're so athletic and physical and you lose it all.
But that's probably how you got survived too, isn't it? The fact that you were.
Yeah, that's probably healthy. because that's probably helped a lot in my survival because even the doctors are saying to me now, like not very few people survive what you've survived and including 3 bouts of double pneumonia. Yeah.
Did you, when you had come to terms with dying before, and then you just keep surviving. What that must be a peculiar double-edged thing.
Well, I wanted to die a few of the times.
Right.
The second time I got pneumonia, I knew I had pneumonia because I could tell from the first time.
Right.
And I decided that I had enough, so I thought I'm just going to sit at home and die. And that's what I planned to do. So I sat at home for a couple of days, and by that point I was getting very weak and I knew I was going down the loo.
Right.
But a friend intervened. It was just one of those things where the higher forces at play.
Yeah.
She rang me. I spoke to her on the phone. I played it all down. I didn't tell her how bad I was. And then she got off the phone. She thought, he's talking shit. So she got in the car and drove to my house and just – I knocked on the door and I opened the door and said, what are you doing here? And she goes, get in the car. I know what you're trying to do. She knew I was basically doing a suicide hit because I just couldn't handle coming back again. Because coming back means I can't walk, I can't do anything, I'm so weak, I'm in bed, and I've got to get up and try and walk again, start all over again and try and survive again, and it's just too hard. when you've been through it four or five times, and all the times I've been in hospital, I just thought, I'm just happy to go. But here I am. So I survived that, and then I survived it the next time as well. So, but usually when I get through those situations, my sister takes me in and I go and live with her for a while because I can't do anything for myself. Mm. And then when I can, I try and teach myself to do things again.
Yeah.
When I get strong enough, I go back and live on my own again. Yeah, that's what I've
been
doing.
Is there a kind of – do you remember actually deciding you were going to try and prepare yourself for understanding these things that we all need to do, like doing meditation, to like we were talking about earlier about consciousness and our understanding of that and letting go of self and all these things that people do in meditation and other things. Did you make a conscious decision to do that as a way of accepting your mortality? Like, did you strategize it? Did you go, right, yeah, I'm going to try to.
Well, I already had a practice before I got sick. I had a meditation practice, and I'd been through some tough times before I got sick, and I got into meditation, and I got into Buddhist philosophy and going to the temple and all that kind of stuff. So I was already aware of that kind of thing, and I also really got into doing a lot of community charity work and raising money for people less fortunate than myself before I got sick.
Mm.
You know, I was runner-up citizen of the year in the city of Glenara because I was nominated for all my charity work, all the money I'd raised for people. And I used to run free classes for disabled people and people with mental illness and pensioners at my gallery that I funded. So I was already into all that stuff, not because I'm trying to say I'm the best person in the world, but because it's not about me. And you really realize that, you know, the only important thing or valid thing you can do on a day-to-day basis is try to help somebody else. And when I got sick and went through all what I've been through, that just compounded that even more. So even now, I try to do whatever I can to support other people, including other cancer patients, in the hospital, whoever. And I still do charity work. I do whatever I can on every level because I feel that's the only purpose I have.
And it helps you. We know this helps.
It definitely helps, like, you. It helps you with depression, helps you with everything.
Well, Hugh from the Resilience Project was in here talking about, you know, empathy and mindfulness and whatever the other one, gratitude.
Yeah.
And gratitude and empathy in being of service to other people just gives you a kind of, gives you meaning, doesn't it? It gives
exactly.
you this meaning that's beyond all this other shit.
Yeah.
So it's kind of.
That's all that matters, really, to me. You know, I've got enough money to eat tonight and I've got a place that I own and that's all I need. Mm. So anything else I can give away or I can do, I'll do it, you know, because I think it makes me feel good and valid as a person.
That's the thing. It's making you, it's actually making you, it's like there's no such thing really as total selflessness and altruism. Like, it doesn't even have to be that. Like, it actually makes people feel good to do
it. Yeah, it does, because selflessness comes from a place, to a degree, of believing that you're an individual and everyone else is separate from you.
Yeah, yeah.
And selflessness, that word, seems to put a barrier between you and another person, that you're actually an individual.
Mm.
But I know that fundamentally I'm not really. It's an illusion that I'm an individual. But I'm joined to everybody. Everyone's joined to me.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about this before. So every day when I go out and do things, I try and go out and do stuff every day because it's good for my mental health and to interact with other people. But every person I can get eye contact with, I say hello to, I try and talk to, you know, and be loving and kind to those people because they're me and I'm them. There is no separateness between us.
Why is that so often accompany terminal illness or near terminal illness? You know, like it seems like when people get that shock of either of those, they either just deny it and get angry and don't and pretend it's not happening, or they go the other way and they open up to the world. And you'll see people who, it's very strange, who seem to have lost everything but seem happier. It's like Hugh talking about those kids in India that had nothing but were the most generous, kind kids. And then back home in Australia, we've got everything and we're all riddled with anxiety and, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and we're afraid of what we're going to lose.
You sort of have to have everything taken away from you.
It helps. If you can survive having everything taken away from you, because if your identity, my identity was definitely, a huge amount of it was placed around my body.
Yeah.
Because I was very fit, and people of the opposite sex were attracted to me because of that reason.
Mm.
So, and I was, also the way I walked, the way I talked, the way I held myself was so different being in a body that was 90 kilos, 85 kilos and strong and powerful compared to now. Would I live in a body that's 64 kilos, wasted away, I'm on a walking stick and I'm disabled. A completely different existence. The world sees me in a different way.
Yeah.
Also, because I'm getting older too, but people will walk into me. Some people will see me and they'll get out of my way and help me. But I've fallen over on trams in the street because of my condition, and people have just walked past me unsure what to do. It's like I don't know how to deal with this. So it's really interesting to go from being really seen or feeling seen to feeling like you're invisible. To a degree, it's a really interesting process, and the invisible process helps you to see that you're not what other people see, and you're not whatever you try to project into the world. That's all illusionary as well. You know, it really connects you to the spirit inside, or you go the other way and you go mad. You know, it depends on what you're built with and how you cope and how you can adapt. Yeah.
And this surely is the reason why people say cancer was the best thing that happened to them.
Yeah.
You may have a lot of – hopefully you have less pain if possible, but your life may be shorter. But then what's length of life got to do with anything really?
No, it's about quality. I mean,
I mean, some people live – they're just fucking miserable.
Yeah. You know? I had to do a huge installation once for all these kids with terminal illnesses. I created this whole world. All these performers I got in, I laid 300 metres of grass inside a warehouse, and it was an incredible experience to see all these kids with terminal disease and their families come, you know, hundreds.
Yeah.
But it was all about the fact that it didn't matter how long you lived for, it was the quality of that life. So I tried to give them this whole incredible adventure in the course of a day. Never could I imagine that I'd have to live that philosophy years later by getting so sick myself too. Mm. But it's a really interesting process, because you see that there's some people that get a terminal illness and they pretend they actually want to live to the outside world, but they don't.
They don't really.
Because when they're sick, they seem to get more love, more attention. They become more seen. People seem to care about them more. And they go, do I really want to give this up? Because if I get well, then I won't have this anymore. Mm. People will go back to their own lives and they'll forget about me. Mm. So there's something valid about staying sick. And a lot of people choose to do that and die, because if you want to live or try to live, you've got to empower yourself. And that means you've got to go, I need your empathy, I need your love, but I don't want your energy. I don't want to suck your energy off you. Mm. And you have to fill that energy void yourself when you're sick to try and survive. You know, you've got to find that spark all the time to survive every day. You know, and I've seen people that don't really want to live because they get loved more when they're dying. So they'd rather go that way. And something wrong with that. Yeah. It's just the truth.
Mm.
Yeah.
Are you working?
Like I work, yeah, creating? I paint as much as I can now, but I can't do very much.
Yeah.
You know, I've lost my career. I can't do solo show after solo show. I'm working on another exhibition. But since I've been sick, I've still managed to do quite a few things that has been very challenging. I did some giant murals at Carnegie Station that the council commissioned me to do, and I just couldn't refuse. I still try and do stuff all the time. I was in a lot of pain doing it on a walking stick, but I still try and do things. I wrote a children's book since I've been sick.
Yeah.
It's been published.
We'll put a link in the in the notes for this.
Oh, yeah, cool. It's called Brazania, and I'm working on my third book now.
My wife's a children's librarian. So it's like, hang on.
Yeah. And I'm doing an environmental book. I'm doing a book with the School for Strike movement as well, which is a bit different from what I've done before with books. Mm. So I still do stuff, still make art, do projects, do whatever I can, yeah.
I was going to say, have you changed the nature of your art? If you've gone from this kind of high intensity physical art and found a way to keep creating that doesn't hurt, but it sounds like you just
I have still taking different projects methods that are, now
of
how to make stuff in a very different way.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, but I need to keep sane. I need to keep doing something or creative to stay sane.
Yeah,
yeah.
If you keep being placed back here, it must seem a bit like it must be easy to get a bit kind of woo-woo and mystical about it when you keep surviving.
Yeah.
You like to go, righto, what's going on here? Like something must be, there must be a reason for this,
yeah,
you know?
And, yeah.
And then if that is to do more work or to help people, you know.
But yeah. that has a flip side, that way of thinking.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, if someone is, you know, if someone listening has lost someone, then it might be like, well, they must,
right?
They must have had no reason, you know, to be around.
Well, yeah, but like, I mean, I just imagine if you're in that position,
yeah,
if you're the person who's sick, it would be so strange that you'd have to. It would be like, well, what's going on here? I suppose you could spend a lot of time searching for meaning that doesn't exist too. It's like the why did it happen to me thing that people can get. I imagine that pretty quickly goes.
Yeah.
Because it just is, right?
Yeah, well, I actually never went through a lot of that.
Mm.
I didn't go through the whole, why am I suffering so much? Why am I going through all this? And people would come to me and say, it's really, you know, unfair what's happened to you.
Right.
And I go, why is it unfair if it happened to me? Is it unfair if it happened to Joe or Bill or Bob? There's no such thing as fair or unfair. It just is what it is, you know. Yeah. But there's a lot to be gleaned from suffering a lot.
Yeah.
And I do suffer a lot because I have chronic pain and every day. So I'm in pain all the time and I don't take anything for it. So I endure it. And so it helps strengthen the mind as well.
Well, to be sane like you are, you're not
kind of, I'm not really that sane though.
Well, but you're not like, but you can still laugh and smile and not, like you don't seem bitter.
I'm not really bitter, no.
I mean, you get cranky, like anyway.
I have my moments.
Yeah.
Often I get into the car when I suffer really bad days of pain.
Mm.
I'll get the car, wind up the windows, and I'll scream for 10 minutes, scream my head off.
Mm.
And I cry a lot, you know. But I don't see anything, I don't judge emotions. I don't think this is a bad emotion, that's a good emotion. They're all emotions and they're all good. So kind of I'm happy to cry and happy to laugh.
It's kind of what they're for, right?
Yeah.
Like we often have these displays of emotions for stuff that don't really warrant it. It's like people having a tantrum because their phone did this or that or the other, or getting upset about stuff that doesn't really matter. But situations like that, it is a release, right? The emotional responses are there to actually do something.
Yeah. And I cry at movies. I mean, I'll cry at the hospital all the time.
Yeah, right.
Because I see patients really suffering.
Yeah.
And I start to cry. I just start to cry right in front of them.
Yeah.
Because I can relate to their suffering. I can relate to their pain and their fear. I can relate to their fear as well, you know, because I've had that fear too, where I don't know if I'm going to survive, or especially in the early days when the shock of being diagnosed and realizing I had to go through. Well, thank God I didn't realize at the time what a bone marrow transplant meant.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't want anyone else ever to go through it.
No. So it's an extra. It's a profound experience.
Yeah, I mean, and then you kind of get to the stage where you go, you don't judge experience. You know, it's not a good experience or a bad experience. Like all these experiences that you go through in life are all experiences of consciousness, and one's not better or worse than another. It's just different. And if you see it as being really bad and really negative, then that's what it will be.
Mm.
If you see it as being something that has things to offer, has fruits on the tree, then you'll get some of those fruits too. So, but it's not easy to think like that or to be like that, but sometimes it's all that keeps you going is to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing about human beings, really, that we can do that if we want to. We can flip everything. I mean, nothing is one thing.
Now, and there's so many remarkable people around that go through some serious shit. And how they come out the other end, you just go. And often people go, I can never go through what you've been through. And you go, you just don't know.
Yeah.
You can never say that because you don't know till it happens to you what you're capable of until you're tested.
And what you'll learn.
Yeah, and what
that
you'll learn.
You may otherwise never learn.
That's right.
So many people, not that you would wish any of this on anyone, but some people go through their lives and can get to the end of their life having never done any work and be faced only with the idea of losing everything, which is really tragic if your only option to view it is just a dead end.
Yeah.
And that's not about afterlife or anything. Mm. It's just about meaning and how important it all is, you know. So it's fucking strange, that double-sided. And your son's going to, you know, it'll be interesting as he gets older too to understand – as he understands you more too.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, there's a whole legacy that I have behind me. I mean, my children's book, I got a special first edition for him. Mm. He's never even looked at it, never read any of the stories. So I don't, definitely don't push onto him, you know, what I do and what I've done. I just don't bother.
But you've got a great your life's very tellable. So what I mean is, as happens with all kids, they're going to get to a stage, whether you're here or not, of wanting to know about their parents or their father. So one day he's going to go on that quest to know more about what it all meant for you.
Yeah, if that happened, that would be great because
it's guaranteed.
There'd be lots of stuff there for him. There'd be lots of stuff there that you could because there's been two books now, the first
book. Yeah, you've got stuff.
And the third book. And so there'd be all that stuff as well as there's lots of public art pieces I've done that you can go and have a look at.
And just people who know you
too. Yeah,
you
so know, like, there's all that there if he's interested. But he might not be interested.
Well, he might not be, but it's like we all think that about after our death, you know. Like, but most people, like my kids, the odds of them after I die having no interest in who I was are pretty slim. Like you at some point want to reckon with, not that that even matters, but it's just that there's stuff. That
people want to know where they come from and what makes them feel that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the stepfather might be a really good, I don't know, architect or something like that, or an accountant, right? But you know, it happens with adoption. You know, it's like, why am I feeling this way? You know, my parents have got this set of kind of values or feelings or priorities, and it's great to have that knowledge all the way down.
And
when a 6-year-old doesn't show interest, that's bloody normal.
Sometimes they're in their 20s or 30s. You know, like you've got such a strong story and such a that you've cut. You know. There's such extremes. It's verging on biblical, your story.
Biblical.
Well, you know, like extremes of kind of, you know, having it all be about your body and physicality and your world so reliant on what you physically can do, and then to have that taken away from you and forced to face other things. This is epic sort of stuff, you know.
I guess my whole life's been very intense, very full. I've had to go through a lot of shit, you know, including, you know, I had my building when I built it, and I had an arson attack, and that I took the bank to court. It was just all very stressful and extreme, you know. And then I somehow survived all that, but I was going through panic attacks and
Job. You know the story of Job, right?
Yeah.
It's a bit like that.
No, so
it's, like but how long are you going to maintain it might not be God in this case, but it might be just your faith in life or humanity or something.
Mm.
Like these things have been thrown at you, like poor old Job.
Yep.
And are you gonna just give up and just say fuck you to everyone?
Well, I've got a lot of discipline, and I'm a very driven person. Mm. So even now, you know, I get up in the morning and I do exercises. I'm in pain doing them, and there's no one around. I do them on my own. So I'm very self motivated and self driven. I always have been, and that's probably why I had such an intense life so far with everything, with my career and everything, making it work. It's been probably that self-drive and that discipline. I'm really disciplined because, you know, I was a powerlifter, I was a bodybuilder, you know, I won a title in powerlifting, I won a state title. So to do all that stuff in one lifetime takes so much discipline to lift all those weights and go and train on your own and then transcend that and move on to something else, you know.
To bring it all full circle a bit, I mean, that's a big part of why I was drawn to you, because you had so much energy and commitment to the exploration of this art and work, and I hoped some of that would rub off on me. You know, like I've been so frightened and distracted and well, some of which we know why now, but like all my issues and just being around you and your stuff is so focused and intensive and interesting, because we used to have those conversations. Well, and you'd keep painting, of course, but just about you know, philosophical ideas and just about what it is to be engaged with your life. So well,
I think part of the reason I was really driven is because I was brought up with very low self-esteem because I was beaten up and my mother was depressed and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I felt if I wasn't doing something, I was nothing. I was invisible.
Right.
So to feel alive, like a shark, if it stops swimming, it drowns. Mm. That's how I felt. So I felt if I wasn't doing, I was nothing. So I became obsessive and compulsive, and I just could not stop doing all the time.
Yeah, but you also you gave it out as well, which is because it can go the other way. Some people become that and become very selfish. You always had time for me and to kind of encourage all that sort of stuff, which is great, you know. We need to do that for
other people. I always loved helping other people. I've gone to a lot of schools and spoken to kids, done a lot of mentorship and projects in schools as well, because I still do all that kind of stuff. You know, I think it's so important.
That's the flip side to that driven thing, because it can, you know, if you don't have that element, you can just become a prick, really.
Yeah, and being too self-indulged is pretty fucking boring.
Yeah.
And not helpful to anybody else, that's for sure.
Well, maybe you probably think it's going to be taken away from you at some point.
Before we wind up, first of all, we'll get to your what's coming up kind of vibe. If you've got anything coming up, like exhibitions or any like
I've been doing a few group shows. I'm doing another solo show next year.
Yeah.
So I haven't confirmed the dates yet. Yeah. But I'm doing that. So I'm working slowly towards that because I just can't make paintings that quickly anymore. Yeah. And I'm working on these two books. One is a book that's all snippets of my life. It's different stories that friends have been pushing me for years to write. Because I was a stripper for 4 years you know, hitchhiked around Africa. I've been abducted. So I've been through a lot of shit. So there's all these little stories. But this book's very philosophical. It's not like I was born on this day, blah, blah, blah. It's not one of those kind of biographies. Yeah. It's a bit different.
Yeah.
It's just more extracts of stories. And also going through all the cancer stuff and everything. And the other book that I've, because I'm really into trying to do something about the environment, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I'm working with the school strike kids. I approach them, and I've been trying to get this project off the ground for a while now. My publisher, who published my first two books, is going to publish this book too. So I'm working on that as well as working on the other book. So. And between that and the exhibition, a couple more public art pieces as well. Hopefully,
oh wow,
that's the plan at the moment.
Well, we'll get notes to everything and links up on our show page, and I look forward to the biography type book because I think there's got to be. I know you
could be just a pile of shit.
You help a lot of people that are disadvantaged and suffering.
But every time you're a bit like Jack Charles in that way. Every time I sit down with him, there's another. Yeah. Like the stripper stories.
Yeah. Well, you help a lot of people that are disadvantaged, but I think this book might help a lot of people like us that aren't disadvantaged but maybe crippled by normal life and can't see, you know, just can't see how
good things are. I'm hoping I can get the book finished because it's a massive job. I've done a lot of work on it already.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping it can somehow touch or affect one person out there. It's very honest, very open and very... You know, revealing.
Well, definitely our time today has definitely touched me. I'm inspired. I want to read the book. Hurry up.
Well, thank you. It's been great to be on your show, and I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, man.
And I hope it's of some help to anybody out there. That'd be great if it was.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks, man.
Thank you.
See you soon.
That awesome podcast was recorded at Castaway Studios in Collingwood. Here, we provide affordable, accessible, professional podcasting production facilities to the full range of podcasters, all the way from basic studio hire right through to full season production packages. You can get us on castawaycollingwood@gmail.com or just look up Castaway Studios on all the social medias.